Welcome to the September 2nd, 2025 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Board. For everyone joining us in the meeting, please turn off or silence your cell phones. This meeting is being webcast recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in physical location and is also available via remote. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted with your camera off until it's your turn to speak. The host will unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and you may choose to exit the meeting or continue. Board Member Gonzalez, would you lead us to the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yes. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Before we continue, I would like to ask the clerk to do a roll call.
Okay. Chair Perez?
Here.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Good afternoon. Present.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Present.
Board Member Music?
Present.
Board Member Satin?
Present.
Board Member Wright?
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. For the purpose of this public meeting, the regional board members to obtain testimony and information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado River Basin region regarding water quality issues. We welcome hearing from the public at this time. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions for those items listed on today's agenda. You will make your comments at the time of the item being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will generally be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted the speaker cards for the forum. Madam Clerk?
We do not have any.
Thank you. Okay, we now move to the agenda to item 3, which is the review and approval of the minutes for the board prior meeting on July 1st. Does any board member have comments or wish to propose changes to the minutes?
I just have a question. Does a board member have to have attended that meeting in order to approve the minutes at this meeting?
No.
Thank you. I'll approve to approve the minutes. Motion to approve.
I'll second.
Okay. Madam Clerk.
Chair Perez?
Yes.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
I'll abstain given my absence.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. For agenda item 4, the board will now hear an update from Laurel Firestone, our liaison to the State Water Resources Control Board.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me here. Good to see you all. I have a few updates. I'll start with the adoption of our intended use plan for both the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. So these are our annual plans for how we are spending our federal funds. So we adopted those this year. We haven't yet adopted the 25-26 fund expenditure plan for the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, but we expect to do that at least by the end of October. We're also continuing to hold hearings on the Delta Conveyance Project. The Administrative Hearings Office has released a 6 amended hearing notice, and the more information can be found on all of the many many hearing days for that on the project website. We Also on the Bay Delta, we released a updated Bay Delta plan update for consideration for hearing on September 24th and 25th. So those are the hearing dates. Written comments on this draft are due September 29th. We also adopted updated water measurement and reporting regulation. So this was updating, it's sometimes known as SB 88, but diversion measurement and reporting regulation. And we adopted that last month. We are also going to be considering later this month our annual fees changes. So there have been ongoing stakeholder meetings to discuss fees for all of the programs across the water board. We expect to be considering updates to our fees at the second September board meeting. And I think the last thing I wanted to highlight is that we're continuing to work through our convening of an expert panel on the irrigated lands regulatory program. So the first public meetings were held over 2 days, August 8th and 14th. And some folks from the Region 7 area participated in with other regional boards and giving kind of an update on implementation of the irrigated lands program across different regions of the state. We have specific questions that are focused on two aspects. This all came out of an order we issued in 2023 related to the Central Coast adoption of their irrigated lands regulatory program. And so the issues that we are asking the panel to consider are whether we're able to, and if so, what they should be. If we're able to establish targets or limits on nitrogen loading to groundwater in order to protect water quality. So this is what would be an appropriate metric to do that, how might we approach that for groundwater protection and probably considering different crop needs and different regions of the state. And the other questions relate to how we might bring in things like cover crops or different farm, sort of sustainable farming practices into the nitrogen balance determination. So there's very specific questions. I'm not gonna read them all, but that's my summary of the two bigger picture topics that we're asking for specific responses on. There's a lot of interest statewide. I think this set of recommendations will then inform how the state board may want to continue to evolve the irrigated lands programs across the state. So look forward to more discussion on that. There's future meetings are planned for October 31st and I believe it's the 14th of January, but I may be wrong about that, sometime in January. I can continue to keep the board updated, but I just recognize that Region 7 had some good participation in talking about the unique needs and dynamics in this area. And that's it.
Thank you. The board will now move on to the calendar of uncontested items for adoption. All items appearing under the uncontested items calendars are acted upon by the board in one motion without discussion. There are two items on the uncontested calendar. Items are 5 and 6. Item 5 is the rescission and substitution order for rescinds existing orders for various facilities and projects within the Colorado River Basin region. The affected facilities and projects include the evaporation infiltration ponds at Bashford's Hot Mineral Spa, a component of SoCal Gas Pipeline Safety Enhancement Plan Line, Caltrans replacement of rock slope protecting along Interstate 10, the Alta Mesa Wind Project, the Mesa Wind Repower Project, the unused general NPDES permit for treating underground from volatile organic compound cleanup actions, the Best Western Joshua Tree Hotel wastewater treatment system, MECA 2 Class 3 waste management facility, and the Heber Geothermal Plant evaporation and holding basins. And item 6 is a waste discharge requirement order for the Southern California Gas Company, Line 3000E, Phase 2A, Remediation Digs Project, and San Bernardino County. Regarding the uncontested calendar, does any board member wish to remove either of these items from the uncontested calendar? No?
I just have a question. On the two wind farms out there, what was it? Is it just for construction and that's completed the work that's completed that says on these graphs here?
Just give me one second.
Oh, maybe they never were developed. Maybe that might be the other.
They've been built out.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe those are dredge and fill orders that the project was completed.
But it's a project that's still out there. It was completed. So construction
yes, my understanding
was
is,
completed?
My understanding is that was for, those would have been dredge and fill, a dredge and fill permit where they obtained the right mitigation and no more further ongoing requirements under the order.
Thank you.
Thank you. If any member of the public wishes to remove an item from the uncontested calendar, you need to have filled out a speaker card. Madam Clerk, are there any speaker cards on these two items?
No, there is not.
Thank you. Can I get a motion on the uncontested items listed and a second?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, may we have a roll call?
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. There are no items today on the contested and discussion calendar. The board will now move on to information items on today's agenda, including items 7 through 10. For agenda item 7, the board will now hear a presentation from Office of Enforcement on the enforcement process of prioritization to resolution. The presenter for this item is David Boyers, Assistant Chief Counsel in the Office of Enforcement. This will be an informal item only. No actions will be taken. Mr. Boyers, please proceed.
I am going to jump up before David and introduce myself and just do a brief introduction. Good afternoon, Chair Perez. Members of the board, my name is Yvonne West. I'm the director of the Office of Enforcement, and I want to thank you for making time for us on your agenda today. And I also want to thank your EO, Mr. Plasencia, for inviting us up here to talk to you about enforcement. It's always a pleasure to be able to interact with the board outside of a specific enforcement context where we're going up against a specific individual or entity. And I really value the opportunity to take some of your time today. I'm lucky enough to have with me David Boyers, my Assistant Chief Counsel over our Regional Board Programs Legal Branch, and Catherine Haw, an attorney for with the same Regional Board Legal Branch in our office. And before I turn over the presentation to them to go through the enforcement process with you, I just wanted to take a moment, introduce myself, discuss our office generally and what we do and how we play a role in your enforcement, and then highlight some of the other staff and resources in the Office of Enforcement that are available to you as a regional board. In way of introduction, again, my name is Yvonne West. I've been a practicing attorney in the area of environmental and water law for over 20 years, which makes me feel really old. But I've had the privilege of serving a majority of that time with the State Water Board after leaving private practice, first as an enforcement attorney, prosecuting both before regional boards and the state board, and then more recently as the director of the Office of Enforcement for the last 7 years. Prior to becoming an attorney, I worked as an environmental consultant in the Bay Area, working primarily on base closures, conducting lead and asbestos abatement remediation, as well as tank pools, ordnance removals, PCB cleanups, and other miscellaneous cleanup work. And I can tell you that I have a distinct memory of being sent to Calumet, Michigan, still towards the end of winter, and having to try to pull hydrocarbon samples out of the soil after we removed an underground storage tank. And I thought to myself, law school can't be that bad. So I did go back to law school after being out of undergrad for about 4 or 5 years. Found myself in private practice for a number of years with a small Sacramento firm doing municipal law and water law. And then in 2006, I joined the Office of Enforcement. The office had just been formed, and it was created in recognition of the fact that enforcement is essential to achieve the Water Board's mission of protecting water quality, water supply, and water availability for the benefit of present and future generations. I can say not a day has gone by in my role in the Office of Enforcement where I haven't learned something new about one of our program areas. It's just been an amazing journey of growth, and just there's so much that we do as the water boards and so many areas to learn about and so many great achievements that we've been able to accomplish as a team. Our goal at the Office of Enforcement is to promote fair, consistent, and transparent enforcement of both water rights, water quality, and drinking water laws. We do this by ensuring that violations are properly investigated, documented, and enforced in accordance with the applicable laws and the Water Board's policies. In addition to providing the regional board's legal support, which you often see our attorneys, you'll see them in individual actions, they work directly with your staff. We also have a significant number of technical staff in our office that provide expertise both in their technical fields as well as in enforcement itself, doing that documenting and investigating that can assist staff that may not be as familiar with the process, and we're always accessible to you. We have environmental scientists, geologists, and engineers. We have a special investigation unit, an underground storage tank unit that focuses on leak prevention. We have a fraud prevention unit that focuses on financial fraud issues, specifically with the UST fund, but also in other areas of our grants and loans programs. And then we have a small cannabis enforcement unit in the office that helps provide support statewide for our cannabis enforcement efforts dealing with illegal cultivation and impacts that we see from cultivation generally. Most recently, our office has taken on some additional resources to assist the Division of Drinking Water. This is the newest area where we're engaged as an office. And I wanted to mention that and share that with you just to highlight the fact that our office has a broad scope of expertise and depth in multiple water board program areas. And it's a unique opportunity for regional board enforcement staff to coordinate across those areas. We're starting to see more and more water quality cases that also have a drinking water component. Sometimes it's really helpful to have staff and attorneys in our office that are familiar with both program areas, assist the regional boards in finding the right folks to talk to within even our own organization, because sometimes we're doing so much that sometimes it's really hard to even identify the right person to talk to about where those programs intersect. So with that, I just wanted to really thank you again for having us here and hope to open an open dialogue. This is a great opportunity for some more conversational approach. If you have questions about anything we're about to present to you today, please feel free to speak up and talk, you know, write down your questions or jump in. Again, it's just really valuable for us to be able to come here and to meet you and talk to you and outside of some specific enforcement case. So thank you, and I hope you find this valuable.
Thank you. Quick question.
Yeah.
When you talk about enforcement, though, it's nothing to do with Prop 218 and rates, correct?
That's correct. We don't have any enforcement authority over Prop 218 issues.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. Again, nice to see you all. My name is David Boyers. I'm the Assistant Chief Counsel, as Yvonne said. Usually when we travel from Sacramento to the desert, it is markedly hotter here. I am happy to say it is not hotter, but it is like really humid here today. So I am surprised by the amount of water in the air. So today, Catherine and I are going to present to you on enforcement. I'm going to talk generally about a high-level enforcement process, basically how we find cases, how we move them through the process to final resolution. And then Catherine's going to talk to you more specifically about our enforcement policy penalty methodology, that is how we calculate penalties, and then talk to you about the enforcement policy updates that we worked on over the last 5 years that recently took effect. And there's not a clicker, so I will just say next slide. Perfect. So here are the things outlined. What I'm going to talk, I'm going to start about talking to you about how we find cases and how we prioritize them for enforcement. I'll move on and discuss the concept of separation of functions. We'll talk about the enforcement roles of all the teams involved when we separate functions. I'll get into the enforcement tools that we have, the formal enforcement tools, talk a little bit about settlements, and then finally, administrative civil liability hearings, how we issue complaints, the various options we have for that. And as I said, Catherine will get into the other topics. Next slide. So how do we find all of these violations that eventually end up in the enforcement mechanism? They come to us from a variety of sources. And your staff do a terrific job going out and doing inspections. A lot of them, the enforcement cases come about during those inspections. We will go out, let's say, to a construction site. We will see missing BMPs. They'll write up a violation. Hopefully the violations are resolved at that point. If they're not, then they may move through this enforcement process. We also get cases from public complaints. I've had a case in your region where there was an SSO and it was reported by a member of the public who was walking down the street and saw and smelled an odor, reported it to our office, who then followed up. We ended up settling that case. I think it was brought to you a couple years ago. Dischargers also submit a myriad of reports to us, which we review and can find violations in those reports. A lot of times we'll deal with MMPs from MPDS facilities. Those are identified in those reports. Sometimes they don't submit reports. That's also a violation. And then sometimes we have enforcement that just comes out of an initiative. One example of that is our efforts to enforce the Yucca Valley Basin Plan prohibition, and we're, with Michael's help, working to get as many folks in compliance with that as possible and then bringing to you cease and desist orders and then ACLs for those folks who don't come into compliance. Next slide. So of all these violations that we find, what do we do with them? Well, hopefully, the best case scenario is we will make a phone call or we will send an email or a notice of violation, and that will incentivize the discharger or the responsible party to come back into compliance, and then we're done. And we refer to this as informal enforcement. That's the ideal case. Next slide. We'll talk about informal enforcement. For those cases where we're not able to successfully bring a discharger back into compliance, they will get teed up and discussed among your staff and our attorneys at what we call case prioritization meetings. We meet at least quarterly with your staff, your assistant executive officer, and your lead staff for the various programs to discuss all those cases that were not successfully brought back into compliance with informal enforcement. We look at the unique facts of those cases. We also look at the enforcement policy and decide which one we should prioritize to move through the formal enforcement process. Your staff will fill out a form. They'll send it to us. They'll ask for an attorney to be assigned. I have 10 attorneys that I supervise, all with various specialties. And so I will assign it to somebody to work with your staff. And then we will continue to meet with your staff as that case progresses through the enforcement process. And I will actually stop and say I have like 33 slides. So if you want to interrupt me, please feel free to do so. It's a lot of talking up here. And so we may or may not come back to this. There's a final slide for questions. But please, if you have a dying need to ask me a question, feel free to interrupt. Next slide. Okay, so once an attorney from our office has been assigned, we separate functions and we create a wall between the staff who are advocating before you in a prosecutorial role and staff who are advising you as in your role as decision makers. We call this separation of functions. And it arises basically out of due process, fairness. We want you to be a neutral decision maker and not have had conversations behind closed doors or separately with the prosecution team trying to advocate a result without having the dischargers present to hear what we're saying. In the next slides, we'll talk more specifically about the various teams that we set up to maintain that neutrality. Next slide. So first, the prosecution team and the advisory team. Your prosecution team is headed by your assistant executive officer, Cassandra Owens, who is not here today. We also work with Michael Perez, who is your compliance and enforcement supervisor, and then perhaps regional staff, the inspector who went out and did the inspection, or other technical staff who we need to advocate a particular issue on that team. And of course, the Office of Enforcement Attorney, whether that be myself or one of my attorneys. And then your advisory team, the folks who advise you, are your executive officer, your regional board technical staff, if you have technical staff who can't have been on the prosecution team, they have to be separate, and of course your OCC attorney. Next slide. This is just an overview of the things that we do as prosecution team. As I said before, the first thing we do is we prioritize cases. We meet with your staff. We decide which ones are the worst that need to be brought before you. We're advocates. When we're appearing before you, we are advocating for a particular result. If we're in a settlement posture, we're the ones who are negotiating the settlement. We'll bring it before you for approval. We work with the dischargers to get SEPs, and we'll talk a little bit about those later.
Is there a statute of limitations? Do you have to move by a certain
That's a really good question.
Time?
There is not a formal administrative statute of limitations. If we refer the case to the Attorney General's office, it is generally a three-year statute of limitations. But if we go beyond 3 years, then the dischargers may raise a defense of latches. And latches means it's basically a stale case. In that case, the burden shifts to us to explain why we were so late and why they're not prejudiced. So the answer is no, there's not a statute of limitations, but we try our best to do it within 3 years because then it becomes more difficult for us. If we end up at a hearing before you, hopefully within 3 years, we will present our best evidence and our best argument, and we will ask you to return a decision that is consistent with what we believe the appropriate resolution should be. And of course, we do our best to answer your questions. Next slide. And of course, your advisory team's primary role is to advise you as the decision maker in conducting the hearing. They can request that the parties submit briefs on a particular issue. They assist you when you go back into closed session and you ask your attorney or your advisors questions. If the order is challenged, they're generally the ones who represent you in court on a writ for that order. And of course, they're the ones who will advise you as to whether your order is in compliance with all the relevant policies and statutes. Next slide. And your role, you are the decision maker. You hear the evidence and argument, you weigh the credibility of the witnesses as they testify, you look at the evidence, you read the briefs, you consider public comment, and obviously you hopefully formulate and issue a decision at the end of the day. And you have the ultimate authority to make all policy, procedural, and legal and factual decisions in that order. Next slide. All right, moving on to the various tools. And these are generally formal enforcement tools that we have that we work with your staff to hopefully get to a resolution to bring the discharger back into compliance. The first is we have the authority to issue investigative orders, and you may have heard these described as 13267 orders or 13383 orders, and that's just a reference to the Water Code Authority that provides us the ability to issue these orders. These are orders for dischargers to produce technical or monitoring reports. We frequently use these, so in response to a sanitary sewer overflow, we will often issue these orders and say to the discharger, produce a report and tell us how many gallons were discharged. That is not always reported. Sometimes it's reported into CWIX, but sometimes we want a more detailed analysis, so we can use them for that purpose. We also have authority to issue investigative subpoenas. That's actually a pretty powerful tool, akin to what the Attorney General's office can do. We use these when we want to investigate a particular issue before issuing a complaint. So, for example, if we have questions about corporate organization or corporate successorship, we can get that information and figure out who the responsible party is that needs to be named on the complaint. Cease and desist orders. You're all familiar with cease and desist orders. We've presented a number of cease and desist orders to you recently. These are when we have a discharge or a threatened discharge in violation of requirements. We can order somebody to come into compliance within a certain time frame. Cleanup and abatement orders, akin to a cease and desist order, but a little different. This is when a discharge or threatened discharge of waste has occurred. We can order somebody to go out there and do some work to either clean it up or abate the effects. ACLs, which we'll talk about. And then the last two, referrals to the AG's office. We'll talk about, there's a particular slide on that, and then referrals to another prosecutorial agency. These are generally referrals to the DA's office if the violation involves a crime or a criminal element. Okay, next slide. ACLs are really one of the most powerful enforcement tools that the water boards have. And I'm going to talk quickly about several pathways that we have to imposing liability. Compressed ACLs, settlements, and then traditional ACLs. Next slide. Compressed ACLs, this is a relatively new tool that was developed in response to staff in Region 5's experience that ACLs just took really a long, long time to get folks in, you know, back into compliance. It was a very inefficient enforcement tool. And so she came up with the idea about, if you've got an obvious violation, you go out there and you do an inspection and you see a violation, is there not an easier way to impose a penalty? And so we came up with this tool that we've coined a compressed ACL. It is a single document. It's like a little fix-it ticket, not a fix-it ticket, but it's a fix-it ticket with a penalty. So it's a document that says we, you know, went out there, we found a violation, you're subject to this liability. Here's what we propose the penalty is under the enforcement policy. If you agree to this, sign it off, and then we'll send it to your executive officer for their signature, and then we're done. You know, there's somewhat of a limited utility. I think we've done it once in this region, somewhat of a limited utility for this. If it's a big dollar case, normally the dischargers will want to discuss more and have it and maybe contest it. If the violations are not that obvious, they might want to come in and have a discussion with you. If there are legal issues that they want to contest, it generally doesn't work. But for low dollar cases, simple violations, sometimes this tool works. Next slide. So traditional settlements. This is the meat and potatoes of what we do in the Office of Enforcement. Most of the cases that we have don't go to a compressed ACL and they don't go to a full hearing. They settle after we have engaged with a discharger in a traditional settlement process. And we have two options for when we engage with the discharger. So we've found the violations, we've decided it warrants enforcement, and we want to move forward with an ACL. Most of the time, we will reach out and we will discuss this first option, a pre-ACL issuance. That means before we even issue the formal charging document, we will call the discharger and say, hey, you have a number of violations which subject you to liability. Come in and talk to us. The benefit of that is, obviously, we hear things that we may not know that may change our mind about how we're looking at this case and the penalty. It is way more efficient if we are able to reach a settlement than if we go to a full evidentiary hearing. And there's a lot less pressure. If we issue a complaint, there are certain timelines and deadlines that apply to us. So this gives us a little bit of flexibility and a little more time to reach a final resolution. Obviously, the dischargers are not under a lot of pressure. So sometimes they will just kind of drag things out until there's that real pressure of a complaint. So that's the downside. We can also issue the complaint and then discuss settlement with them. That's what we call post-ACL issuance. This shows that we're serious. We're moving forward with an ACL, but our document is out there and it's public and our position is public. So if we're going to learn something and change our opinion, we have to be very transparent about that. You know, the downside for that is we're basically on a hearing path. There's a lot of resources that we have to invest. We have to start gathering evidence, making arguments, because if it doesn't settle, we've got a hearing date on the horizon. Next slide. Why do we settle? I say we settle about 90% of our cases. Why do we settle the vast majority of our cases? Well, a number of reasons. There is certainty in the outcome. When we have a settlement, well, I would say most certainty until we bring it to you for approval. But once we have an agreement among the parties, we have certainty in what the outcome we hope it will be. Vastly fewer staff resources go into a settlement. Catherine was recently involved in a major hearing in the North Coast region in Region 1. They had a three-day hearing. They took depositions of, I don't know how many people, 10 or more people, briefing, hundreds of pages of briefing, subpoenas and PRA requests, just months and months and months of really hard work. So we avoid that if we end up in a settlement. And we can, most importantly, I think, is this last bullet, we can obtain concessions or incorporate certain elements that are not otherwise available if we end up at a contested hearing, right? These are things like SEPs, enhanced compliance actions, and we'll talk about those as well. Next slide. Quick sidebar on the importance of confidentiality in a settlement and how that relates to when we bring things to you for approval. There are several code sections, evidence code sections, which establish a confidentiality of discussions that we have with a discharger during settlement, 1152 and 1154. And it assures that the communications during those discussions, it says communications, conduct, and other statements made during settlement are confidential. And the reason, there's a good public interest reason to do that. We want to make sure that we are able to have frank and honest conversations with the discharger and make offers to compromise that then are not going to come back and hurt us in a hearing. So, for example, if we say at a settlement, we're willing to accept $500,000, and they say no, and then we issue a complaint for $750,000 because we weren't able to settle or for whatever the reason is, they can't come before you and say, well, they would have taken $500 in settlement. Why are they asking for $750 now? So, you can understand the importance of making sure that those discussions remain confidential, and they remain confidential even after the case is settled. The downside is if we bring you a settlement and you have questions about that settlement, you say, well, what other things did you consider? Can you tell us? Sometimes we'll say, well, no, that's confidential. Hopefully we're able to get a waiver from the discharger where we can disclose to you some of the options that we considered in settlement. But it depends. The discharger has to agree to that. Next slide. It's important, and as you may have experienced, you may have seen cases in your region that you know are in settlement, where the settlement is just sort of happening and the discussions are happening and you're wondering what is going on. We ask for your patience. Settlements take time, yes.
Just the case you mentioned where you wouldn't disclose information to the board. So hypothetically, the board rejects the settlement. Then does it go through the whole process again, or does the discharger allow us to see?
It could. I mean, those are really good considerations. So you can say, unless you're willing to disclose to us the other steps that you considered, we're inclined to reject this. And then we'll sidebar and we'll say, is that really something we want to do? What is the downside of disclosing some of those discussions? Hopefully, the upside is we'll get your approval. The downside is we're back to square one, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But yes, sometimes, you know, it really depends. Some dischargers are really just not inclined to have those discussions and are not willing to waive. Others may be. So there's a couple possible considerations when we have a compromise. Did you have another question?
No.
Okay. Yes. Oh, yes. yes, they do come up. They come up more frequently than you would think. A couple considerations on why we would reach a compromise. As I said before, sometimes when we're in discussions, we learn new facts. One of the considerations that we often learn is dischargers who claim they can't pay. And we, during settlement, will say, well, prove it to us that you can't pay, and we'll get a bunch of tax returns, and we have expert witnesses that can do an analysis of that. And if it really does indicate they can't pay, then we will be transparent. We will reduce it based on that claim. Litigation risk. There is, as I said, certainty in a settlement, and conversely, uncertainty in a contested hearing. We like to think that the boards will always agree with the prosecution team and how we present a case to you, and you know you're always going to be on our side. That is not necessarily the case. So there's risk in that. So oftentimes we will reduce the penalty by a certain amount in order to avoid that risk. One other consideration. Even in a settlement, we are transparent. And so if we issue a complaint for $500,000, we settle for $250,000. In our settlement document, we will explain to you why we went from $500,000 to $250,000. It's not just some sort of like, well, we thought this was better. And you'll hear from Catherine about all the considerations and the methodology, but we will be transparent in our how we reached a settlement. All right, next slide. Board Member Music, this goes to your question about what happens in a settlement. So this is your role. Generally, when we bring a settlement to you, the vote is yes or no. When we bring a settlement to you, it is not an evidentiary hearing. We are not there to present witnesses, and you're not there to look at the credibility of witnesses or examine the evidence. You're there to say, is this settlement something that we want to adopt or not? If you think there's insufficient information to make a decision, you can say no. Go ask the parties to go get more information. You can reject it. You can say, if you don't resolve this, we want to hear it at a board meeting. You can disagree with its terms. You can say the SEP is not something we want to have you fund, and go back and think of a new SEP, and we can do that. Hopefully, as I said, we've done a good job during settlement, and we've looked at all those different options. We think we do a good job during settlement. We try to find the SEPs that are the best SEPs and bring them to you for approval. So I will say it's rare that we have a settlement that's rejected, but certainly is within your authority to do that. Next slide. All right. So as I said before, one of the bargaining chips that we have during settlement negotiations that we don't have in an administrative contested hearing is the ability to offset a portion of the penalty and allow the discharger to fund a supplemental environmental project, an enhanced compliance action, or a compliance project. And I'll first start by talking about SEPs, what they are, how we find and select them, and then what rules apply to them. Next slide. This is the statutory definition of a SEP. It is an environmentally beneficial project, and the SEP policy clarifies it should be beneficial for water, that a person subject to an enforcement action voluntarily agrees to undertake. We can't compel somebody to do one of these, in settlement of an action to offset a portion of a civil penalty. Some examples of SEPs, just because I like to have real-world things, habitat restoration is one of the things we do, invasive weed eradication, public drinking water, replacement, and then stormwater capture and groundwater recharge are the kind of things that fit within what we traditionally see as SEPs. There's a lot of them, a lot of different categories. Next slide. How do we find these things? A lot of times the discharger will have a SEP in mind, and they will propose those projects to us, and we will look at them, and we will say yes or no. First party SEPs are SEPs that are actually done by the discharger. A lot of our dischargers and violators are municipalities, and sometimes they will have a project that they want to do, and they will actually have the staff and resources to do it themselves. Other times, it's what we call a third-party SEP, where they hire and pay a third party to do the SEP for them. We also have a SEP proposal form on our website, which allows folks, generally nonprofits, to, if they have an idea for a SEP, fill it out, send it in, we'll direct it to the appropriate region. Those, you know, sometimes work. They have limited utility because, remember, when we're in a settlement posture, we've got like a dollar amount, and then we've got certain rules and regulations where we have to find the right SEP for the right dollar amount in the right location. We'll talk about that, but sometimes it can be difficult to pair up a SEP from the list with an enforcement action. And then there's the last category of third-party administered SEPs. In Region 4, and maybe another region, there's an entity called the Rose Foundation that actually goes out and gets SEPs that are presented to them by nonprofits and then works with our regional board staff to get those funded. A lot of those are scalable, so it doesn't matter necessarily the dollar amount. But, Ed, you got a question?
Does the SEP have to be within the service area? Because what if there's no projects and they want to do something outside the service area?
Is that you mean allowable? Region?
Pardon?
You mean region or service? What do you mean by service area?
Of the discharger.
Oh.
Say, for instance, Coachella Valley Water
District. It's on the next slide. We're getting – thank you for the question.
Okay.
It's a good question. Next slide. So what are all the various requirements? These are set forth in the SEP policy. There's a number of requirements that when we get a SEP proposal, we say, does it meet all these requirements? The first is a nexus. And the nexus can either be a geographic nexus or a nature nexus. And the nature of the violation or location of the violation as it relates to the nature of the SEP or the location of the SEP. Most of the time, we rely on the location nexus criteria, and that exists if we have the same site, same ecosystem within the immediate geographic area, that is the same community or watershed, or within a 50-mile radius, right? So, like I said, most of the time, the SEP is within the area of the violation, and so we meet that requirement. The nature element relates to the nature of the violation and the nature of the project. So if you have a violation that is a wastewater facility having a bunch of copper violations and the SEP is a study of new technology to prevent that type of violation, that would work as well, even though there may not be a location nexus. So nexus is one of the important requirements.
Why do you think they limited it to 50 miles, the rationale?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm turning to Yvonne as if she knows. But I don't know the answer to that question.
It's been in the policy since 2017, and I think they were just trying to stay. It's been in the policy since the first water quality policy was adopted, and I think it was just to try to keep it in the same watershed and same area of impact. And I can't say that there was a specific science behind the 50 versus 75, but yeah.
Most of the time, 50 is enough. Yeah. All right, next slide. Oh, wait, no, I didn't finish this slide. Sorry. So nexus, yes, first. Detailed scope of work, detailed budget, time schedule for implementation. We ask a lot, right, because we want assurances that this is going to get done on the schedule and have them report to us that they've met all the milestones. So reporting requirements, a final completion date, and then performance standards. Making sure that they did what they said they were going to do and has the benefit that they assured us will be there. Next slide. How much of our penalty can go to a SEP? And this is in the policy, but generally 50% is the limit. There is an exception for MMPs where we can allow the first 15,000 plus 50% of whatever's left. And if the director approves an exception from the 50%, we can go up to 100%. And there's two circumstances where the director of the office, Yvonne, can allow us to go up to 100%. One is if we prove compelling justification due to exceptional circumstances. That is a rare occasion where we ask her based on that criteria. The far more prevalent exception that we rely on is SEPs located in or that benefit a disadvantaged or EJ community. And in fact, the director has issued a blanket approval memo for those SEPs, and all we are required to do is notify her in an email that we have selected a SEP that is a DAC or EJ SEP, and we're gonna go above the 50% limit. And then if she objects, she can tell us she objects, but that hasn't happened yet. Next slide. Timeline. So the policy says the SEPs have to be completed within 36 months. So 3 years after adoption of the stipulated order, your SEP has to be done. We don't want SEPs that are just ongoing for years and years and years. We want there to be some accountability and some completion of the project. Of course, there's an exception. The director can approve a SEP that is up to 4 years based on a finding that there is an exceptional benefit, exceptional environmental benefit. And then in all of our stipulated orders, there is also a provision for the executive officer to allow for an extension based on good cause, right? So if there's a difficulty getting a permit and they can show to us, there's just no way I could have gotten this permit, the executive officer can also grant an extension of time. Next slide. A really important concept, and this doesn't always make the dischargers happy when we tell them this, but the dischargers have to remain on the hook for the entire penalty amount, and the entire SEP amount, I should say, until the project is done. So they can't just write a check if they've got a third-party SEP. They can't just write a check and say, I paid X to do the SEP. They didn't do it, so go after them. That's not the way it works, and this is stated repeatedly in the policy. They remain on the hook. It's treated as a suspended liability until the project is done. If the project is not done to our satisfaction, then we can actually, even if they've spent a bunch of money on it, we can say, you didn't do the project, and you owe us that liability amount. And that's happened too. Next slide.
All right, quick question on SEPs before
We
move on. Oh, I guess you're still going, but how do you control for, like, additionality with the first party SEPs? Like, how do you make sure that it's not a project that they would otherwise be required to be doing regardless?
Yeah, that's and we do, when it's a first party SEP, one of the requirements is that it not be something that they've already contemplated or dedicated funds to do. And dischargers can make various arguments, but we can generally see if it's a line item in their budget and they've already dedicated funds. But yes, we do look into that, and it can't be that. It has to be something that arises out of the enforcement action. Does that make sense? Okay. Next slide. Nope, sorry. We're on the next slide. Thank you for staying on top of that. Next project is enhanced compliance actions. These are essentially subject to the same rules that apply to SEPs, in other words, the limits and all the reporting and timing elements. But these are projects that are essentially that go above and beyond. They're capital improvement projects that go above and beyond what the discharger is already obligated to do, right? So if the discharger has an MS4 system and they're required to have a bunch of operators and do maintenance, then they can't get an ECA for those operators and maintenance. But my example is smart manhole covers. Not required under the permit, offers a benefit, goes above and beyond, and that is one of the types of enhanced compliance actions that we have allowed folks to do. So they can do a SEP or you can do an enhanced compliance action. It's generally the same. Enhanced compliance actions benefit the discharger certainly more than a SEP does, where it benefits the public. So we like to see SEPs more than ECAs, but sometimes an ECA is the only option. And sometimes they're really good, right? Sometimes they offer a really good benefit. Next slide. All right, the last project is compliance projects. These are sort of a niche project. They have a very limited scope. These are projects that are only available in the context of MMP, so mandatory minimum penalties, and they only are available for small communities with a financial hardship. And these are projects basically where the penalty money goes directly back into the system to fix the problem. Small community with a financial hardship doesn't have a lot of money to pay penalties. We want to assist them in making sure their facility is up to snuff, and so this allows them to essentially reinvest that penalty money back into their system to come into compliance. Okay, next slide. So after we've negotiated all of those projects, found a good SEP, then we get to the process of getting the settlement approved by you. There is a 30 public day notice period, so we put these on the web. We ask for public comment. If we get comments, we will prepare a response to comments, and then we will present them to you. Whether we present them, it depends on the region and their delegations, but oftentimes your executive officer will have a delegated authority, and so we'll present the settlement to your executive officer for signature. In many cases, your delegation will say upon discussion and consideration with the board chair, so that will happen before they will sign. In other cases, you may want to hear the settlement at a board meeting, and you can schedule it in as an agenda item, and we will come before you, and the parties will present the terms of settlement and answer any questions, and then you can have your yes or no vote on the settlement at that point. Next slide. All right. I'm getting towards the end here, and then I'll turn it over to Catherine. ACL complaint. So if everything in our settlement goes south and our efforts fail, then the next step is for your lead prosecution team member, your assistant executive officer, to actually issue a complaint. An issuance of a complaint is essentially a formal pleading document which alleges the violations, sets forth the penalty, goes through the penalty methodology, says what our penalty demand is, and the statute requires that we set that for hearing within 90 days of issuing the complaint. And so you'll see, you know, complaint will go out in September, and there'll be a board meeting in December where this will be on your agenda. Next slide. And that is what we call a contested hearing. Sort of a last resort, but it does happen. You know, these are cases that weren't resolved through informal enforcement, didn't resolve through a settlement process, ended up at a hearing, and here we are before you at a contested hearing. Most of these are handled at your normal board meetings. Hopefully they won't take more than a couple of hours for a relatively basic case. But sometimes, as I said, the boards will have to dedicate other days, multiple days, to hear a complex case, and that has happened. In that role, you are the decision maker, right? We talked before about you hear the evidence, you weigh the credibility of a witness, you sit up there as a judge does on his dais bench and make rulings and issue a final decision. You know, the downside for those is we give up the opportunity for a SEP or an ECA. Because this is a contested hearing. Next slide. Okay, I think this is the last one I have, and I just want to quickly touch on the option to do a referral to the Attorney General's office. I'm not sure whether you have had that opportunity to refer a case for enforcement to the Attorney General's office, where you're essentially, you become the client, and you say, hey, we want the AG's office to represent the board as a whole, and bring an enforcement action in court against this discharger. And there may be a number of reasons why we choose to do that versus bring a case administratively. If there are other state agencies involved, such as the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we want to bring our cases and join them as a whole and have a court decide it, that is sometimes what we do. If there is a need to get injunctive relief, a court-ordered injunctive relief is often a very powerful tool because it comes with it the potential for contempt and jail. If we have resource constraints, we may choose to refer to something to the AG's office. We also have higher penalties, so if there's a need to get a bigger penalty amount, or if we need an additional investigative tools or resources, a number of expert witnesses or something to that effect, we do have the option of asking the Attorney General's office to get involved. And in that case, as I said before, you are the client. You get to make the decisions as if you're the prosecution team, and you say to the AG's office, we want to see X, Y, and Z in this case. And sometimes that can be a really good, effective tool. My next slide is a question slide. If you have questions here, feel free to ask them.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned Mr. Perez trying to get the last 4 or 5% hooked up. Could language been inserted in the septic prohibition 2011 that would prevent that and made them not be able to receive water once sewer was available?
That's a question for your attorney over there on that table, whether we could have done something in the basin plan.
No, because we're not the water provider. It's the water quality control plan is simply our guidance document. It is not legally binding.
So the septic prohibition?
State agencies are required to follow relevant provisions of our water quality control plan. But, for example, High Desert Water District is not bound by the language in our basin plan discharge prohibition.
Do you think it should be?
That would be expressing my personal views.
Okay. And then you mentioned a settlement. So say you reach a settlement in $250,000. How do you collect? How do you enforce?
Hopefully they write a check. there is, once we reach a settlement and we have an order, then I think it goes into the CWIC system, and then there's an automatic invoice that's generated, and 9 times out of 10, we get a check. If we don't get a check, then it goes into collections, and we have certain options for reducing the order to a money judgment and then getting a lien on property. I have a case where we're trying to track down and get money paid to us that is taking a whole lot of the Attorney General's time. So that can be a very time and resource intensive process, but yeah, we go to court.
And OCC attorneys will help with that as well.
Pardon?
OCC attorneys will help with that as well. I've, for Region 5, gone and obtained a judgment. You go and you petition the Superior Court, and you basically attach a copy of our administrative civil liability order, and presto, hey, there's a judgment. And then you proceed with enforcing that judgment as you would in any other case, leaning their property. You could force a foreclosure sale. It's easier when there are tangible assets hanging out there as opposed to, like, garnishing wages or something like that. But anyway.
So what happens if there is a breach between the advisory and the enforcement teams?
When you say breach, are you talking about an improper?
They talk to each other. A couple of them talk. Maybe something like that.
We hope that doesn't happen.
It happens.
Disclosure is the best remedy in such instances if there is an ex parte communication.
There you go.
I didn't hear that, David.
The best sunlight is the best disinfectant, and the remedy there is to disclose it to the other party. So if one of the parties wasn't invited and there was a communication on substantive matters, we do carve out certain procedural things. But if something kind of like the discussion meandered in its way into something that the other party should have been present for, the best option there is to disclose it to the other side, because then they understand what was said.
Could it just foil the whole thing and go up to the state board?
If it's bad enough, then yes, you as a board may not be able to act as an impartial decision maker, depending on what the nature of the conversation was. We do have the option of asking the state board to take it up on their, or to bring it in front of the state board, or to perhaps get the Attorney General's office involved.
That happened many, many years
that's
ago.
That's not great.
If that happened, I really screwed up.
Yeah, and if one of my attorneys reaches out to you separately on a case, please just hang up the phone and call me directly. I appreciate the time. I appreciate your attention. I'm going to hand it over now to Catherine, who's going to talk to you more.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Catherine. I have fewer slides than David, but please feel free to interrupt me at any point with your questions or comments. These are the topics that I intend to discuss, which is statutory authorities for our administrative civil liabilities, and then our enforcement policy, which you've heard much reference to today. I'll briefly go over the penalty methodology and then focus on some of the updates which were part of the 2024 revisions. Next slide, please. So I'm going to start with a discussion on statutory authority. This is not an exhaustive list of all of the water code provisions that inform how we bring our enforcement actions, but this relates primarily to the authority we utilize to impose administrative civil liability. So when we're dealing with waters of the United States, generally we're looking at Water Code Section 13385, which provides maximum penalty of $10,000 a day for each violation, plus $10 per gallon discharged over 1,000 gallons but not cleaned up. the water code specifies that when we're using this authority that we recover a penalty which is at least representative of the economic benefit associated with the noncompliance. In your region, where you have fewer jurisdictional waters under the Clean Water Act, we're looking mostly at Water Code Section 13350, which has a little bit of a different structure, but essentially is the same with lower penalties, allowing for $5,000 per day of violation or $10 per gallon discharged when we are using 13350 and there is a discharge with a cleanup and abatement order in place. The minimum liability is $500 per day. And when there is no discharge associated with the violation, the minimum liability is $100 a day. Two other provisions that we frequently use are Water Code Section 13268, which generally relates to reporting violations, and Water Code Section 13261, which generally relates to enrollment violations, and each of those is a penalty of $1,000 a day. Next slide, please. In addition to those provisions, both Water Code Section 13327 and 13385 outline a number of factors that the water boards must take into account when developing a civil liability in order to arrive at a number that is appropriate. And those are all on the board. I'm not going to read all of them, but essentially the water code asks us to consider specific factors as it pertains to the discharger's conduct, as it pertains to the impact from the violation, and then establish what should be the minimum liability. So, like I mentioned on the last slide, for Water Code Section 13385, the statute itself is explicit that the minimum liability should be the economic benefit of noncompliance, and then our policy further incorporates that requirement to say that the minimum liability for all of our penalties is the economic benefit plus 10%, in order to ensure that at least the economic benefit is recovered to avoid noncompliance becoming the cost of doing business. Next slide.
Quick question. It said ability to pay.
Yes.
What if you determine they cannot pay it?
So what happens? I have never seen an instance where somebody has had zero ability to pay, but certainly we make adjustments, and David alluded to that process often happening in settlement, to lower the liability based on a decision that incorporates an allowance for them being able to continue in business. So if they can't afford to pay and continue in business, it may be a reason to reduce the overall liability. But I do want to emphasize that the board is not required to impose a liability that allows a discharger to remain in business. So ultimately, you could also arrive at a conclusion that says, even though you don't have an ability to pay this proposed penalty, the right outcome is that you go out of business. So the water code doesn't allow for payments. Generally speaking, payment is due within 30 days of the adoption of an order. However, in settlement, that's sometimes an issue that we do have some flexibility on. So the board, if it comes in front of you as a contested item, doesn't have that flexibility due to the provisions of the water code. But as a prosecution team, sometimes we consider payment plans.
And what about an elementary school? You know, it's really not a business, education.
That's true. And I think that you know, to the extent that they're subject to our requirements, they need to comply. And if their noncompliance arises to the level of needing to get attention from our enforcement staff, which, you know, I hope we've emphasized today that we don't go straight to a penalty. You know, we provide a lot of compliance assistance before we end up there. But when we do end up at a penalty, then, you know, we're going to run through the whole process of the methodology. We have another factor, which is other factors as justice may require. So if there's some overarching public interest that merits a reduction to the penalty, the methodology allows for that consideration to take place.
Are there
place.
Any grant funds for entities like this?
There certainly is. I am not an expert in the State Water Board's grants funding programs. However, a lot of times in the enforcement context, we are working with dischargers who are also working with the Division of Financial Assistance to obtain grant funding in order to make the necessary improvements into their facilities.
Thank you.
And those efforts are generally not at odds because we want them to come into compliance and to have the funding they need in order to make the investments needed in their systems. So in order to ensure that all of those statutory factors I just talked about are appropriately considered in each of our penalty actions, the State Water Board has adopted the Water Quality Enforcement Policy, which we usually just refer to as the Enforcement Policy, which in turn establishes a 10-step methodology by which the Regional Board can derive an appropriate penalty for any noncompliance. Through the application of this policy, we arrive at a proposed liability that is fair, transparent, and consistent. Next slide. Just to spend a few more minutes on the goals of the enforcement policy. The intent is that the penalty derived bears a reasonable relationship to the seriousness of the violation, accounting for any harm to beneficial uses and impacts to the regulatory program. The water boards want to eliminate any economic or competitive advantage obtained from any noncompliance, and we strive to provide a deterrent effect both to that specific entity that's involved in the enforcement action and to the regulated community as a whole. Next slide, please. While the policy provides a process to utilize to establish a penalty, it does so in a manner which provides a lot of flexibility to both the boards and the prosecution team depending on the procedural context that the decision is being made. Fairness and the unique factual background of every single case is going to influence the outcome. And as David described earlier today, both the prosecution team and the advisory team play a role in arriving at an outcome that is fair and transparent within the process of the methodology. The prosecution team generally does this at the complaint stage or in negotiating a settlement, and then the advisory team and the board do this when the final order is issued. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to go through the 10 steps. I'm going to do this fairly quickly. This presentation is not designed to be a very detailed discussion as it pertains to this 10-step process. We have done a number of those trainings. We certainly are happy to talk to your staff about those and to you all about that those steps as well. I'm just going to go through it quickly today. If you have any questions, please do feel like you can stop me. So the first three steps are shown on this slide. And for steps 1 and 2, these apply only to discharge violations. And as parts of the analysis as it pertains to these steps is looking at the potential for harm associated with the unauthorized discharge, which we do by considering the degree of toxicity, the harm to beneficial uses, and the susceptibility of the spill to cleanup and abatement. This is then converted to a numeric score based on table 1 within the policy. Can you transition the slide? This should have... Yeah. So here's table 1, and this is just pulled directly from the policy so that you can kind of see the math of it. So a score is generated, a number score, which is the potential for harm score you see on the top, is generated based on the factors I just outlined. And then we consider what the deviation from requirement, which is shown on the left-hand side, is. And together that generates a numeric score, which plugs into the formula, essentially, of the enforcement policy. Next click. Step 3 applies only to non-discharge violations, so for example, a reporting violation, and this also generates a numeric multiplier, which is plugged into the formula, considering the deviation from requirement and potential for harm associated with that non-discharge violation. Next slide. Okay, steps 4 and 5. So step 4 looks at the discharger's particular conduct. As part of this analysis, we are looking at the discharger's culpability, their history of violations, and their cleanup and cooperation. These conduct factors are then applied to the total base liability, which again is just really the math behind the policy, which is what is reflected in step 5. Next slide. Step 6. Step 6 is the economic benefit, which I've spent a lot of time talking about already, but essentially this sets the floor as to what the minimum liability is going to be. It looks at what the discharger should have done in order to prevent the violation and gives a new calculation as to what the benefit is to that noncompliance and the delay in implementing whatever steps they should have done or avoided having to do it at all. Step 7 is consideration of other factors as justice may require. This is very broad and provides the boards with a lot of flexibility to consider, you know, the particular factual circumstances of the case. In my experience, step 7 is often where we make considerations as it pertains to environmental justice or disadvantaged community findings. Step 8 is the discharger's ability to pay and ability to continue in business. We are required to make a finding on this. in general, we do that based on publicly available information, but the discharger has the best evidence of their own ability to pay. So in settlement, we spend a lot of time reviewing documents when the discharger wants to avail themselves of this argument, and we utilize the assistance of our experts to, you know, make those findings. And ultimately, you know, if we're in front of the board, there's no obligation to allow the discharger to continue in business. If their actions are so egregious and the penalty is so significant, that may be a necessary outcome. Step nine just calculates the maximum and the minimum liability amounts. I went over the statutory maximums on the first slide when I talked about the framework. Those numbers are quite high. Once we apply the penalty methodology, we are usually looking at a liability which is significantly lower than the statutory maximum, but we're required, obviously, to arrive somewhere between the minimum and the maximum. And then step 10 is the final liability amount, which is essentially just the application of all the foregoing factors to arrive at a number which is an appropriate reflection of all of the considerations. Next slide. Now I'm going to spend some time talking about the most recent round of updates to the enforcement policy. These updates were adopted by the State Water Board and went into effect in November of 2024, so we're coming up on a year almost under the new enforcement policy. The next couple slides are not an exhaustive list of every single change that went into this 2024 update. However, in general, the revisions were quite narrow in nature and didn't represent a total overhaul of the policy, but just minor clarifications. So starting with updates to the prioritization and communication aspects of the policy, the primary directive of the policy with regards to prioritization is what David talked about earlier, is and that's having a quarterly enforcement prioritization discussion. And in terms of new requirements, the policy recognizes the importance for most of our boards that environmental justice and disadvantaged communities play in terms of prioritizing enforcement. So the new language in the policy makes explicit that we are considering those communities when we are prioritizing our enforcement, though for most of our clients, that work was already happening prior to this language being included. We've also added references to the Water Board's existing racial equity resolution and made a finding that enforcement should be prioritized wherever there is an undue impact on Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And the last change in the section is also a citation to an existing policy, which is the California Native American Tribes section, which cites to the Water Board's tribal consultation policy, recognizing that outreach should be occurring on a government-to-government basis whenever our enforcement actions impact tribal land, tribal interests, or tribal cultural resources. Next slide. To spend a little bit more time talking about environmental justice and disadvantaged communities, one of the important updates for staff in this 2024 policy is a reference to CalEnviro screen, allowing essentially any community which is identified as being disadvantaged in CalEnviro screen to be considered as such for the purposes of our policy. There are also other statutory definitions which are specifically incorporated into the policy. They're all listed here, and the ultimate goal of these changes together was to create a situation where staff would have a very straightforward time identifying a community as qualifying as either disadvantaged or an environmental justice community, and to draft language which was inclusive so that, you know, staff had the leeway and flexibility to avail themselves of the parts of the policy that apply specifically to DAC and EJ communities whenever they felt it was appropriate. Next slide. Two changes that are important to note because they are the substantive changes as part of the revisions to this policy, which means that they are not going to be applied retroactively to conduct that occurred prior to the changes, but they both relate to step four, the methodology which considers the discharger's specific conduct. They are changes to the cleanup and cooperation language that acknowledges that there is some overlap between culpability and cleanup and cooperation, and that a discharger's efforts to correct a violation may play into the scoring of both of those factors. And then there's also been changes to the history of violations language, which recognizes that only stipulated and adjudicated violations are going to count for a history of violation. So just having a notice of violation in the file isn't adequate in order to bump up the score under history of violations, which would increase the liability. it needs to be based on an adjudicated order, which means either a settlement that was adopted by the board or an order that was adopted after a contested hearing. Next slide. Okay, the final set of revisions that I'm going to cover today relate to process and procedures. First, we've removed a footnote discussing latches. The previous footnote became irrelevant after some case law that went into effect between the 2017 and 2024 policy. So David talked a little bit about latches earlier today, but that's been removed. We've also incorporated updated guidance, which is consistent with what your staff have been receiving from our attorneys prior to this policy as it pertains to issuing notices of violation concurrent with orders that can be petitioned. So we've now clarified that any order which is subject to a petition, for example, an investigative order issued pursuant to Water Code Section 13267, should not be combined with a notice of violation so that it's clear to the regulated community what their petition rights are. We've also added two appendices, which I'll discuss here. Briefly, Appendix D, which categorizes the amendments in terms of their date, the dates on which they've become applicable, and Step E, which relates to template hearing procedures. And I'm going to talk more about Appendix E in the next slide. So next slide, please. Okay, so the new template hearing procedures, which are contained in Appendix E, apply to any ACL hearing issued pursuant to Water Code Section 13.323. It is a template which provides a lot of consistency, though some rigidity as well. However, it includes language which allows the template to be modified for a number of specific circumstances, for example, depending on the format of the hearing, and also allows the executive officer, or excuse me, the board chair to make any modifications necessary for good cause to take into account individual circumstances at a particular hearing. Prior to the issuance of an administrative civil liability complaint, the prosecution team will coordinate with advisory team counsel in order to resolve any scheduling issues and get input needed from the advisory team prior to issuing its complaint. And then the complaint will be issued by the prosecution team with the hearing procedures based on the template together. All right, next slide. Okay, and the last thing we wanted to emphasize was new guidelines and information about best practices for interacting with communities impacted by enforcement actions. This new language in the policy does not create an obligation or requirement to do this outreach, but provides some considerations about when that outreach may be particularly beneficial. Primarily, we ask that staff consider how an action may benefit from input from the community, especially when there are disadvantaged or environmental justice communities that are going to be impacted, or California Native American tribes. And then I wanted to highlight as well some of the resources that are available. Every regional board has an environmental justice liaison who they work with, and the State Water Board also has an Office of Public Participation that can provide some services in assisting with doing this outreach, including translation and including coming up with a contact list to help identify non-governmental organizations or community organizations that may be able to partner in doing this outreach. And that is all I have. Our last slide asks for any questions.
So. Yeah, I have a question. When you mentioned the environmental justice and disadvantaged communities now are listed, what is the benefit to the community after this? Are their penalties lower? Or do they don't have to pay? What is the benefit to the communities themselves?
So I think the most important benefit is compliance. Communities that are characterized as environmental justice and disadvantaged communities tend to bear an undue burden of pollution in the state. And so by enforcing in those communities, we ensure that the businesses and public entities that operate therein are, in as good of compliance as more affluent and privileged communities. So that's the first benefit. But there are a number of other off-ramps within the enforcement policy that takes into account the special circumstances of environmental justice and disadvantaged communities. So a lot of times where we see it come up is with supplemental environmental projects and SEPs, which are designed or located in environmental justice and disadvantaged communities, have special rules under the SEP policy that may allow for more funding than would otherwise be available through a SEP, for example. But yeah, it's going to be a case-by-case determination. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we highlight that outreach is important, is to hear from those communities about how they're being impacted by our enforcement actions.
Thank you.
Do we have any additional questions or comments from the board members?
I would just like to thank both presenters. It was very informative. And
thank you.
We might need a refresher in a couple years.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be in front of you all when we don't have a contested item.
Thank you. Okay, turning to agenda item 8, the board will now hear a report from Executive Officer Michael Patricia.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Perez, Vice Chair Gonzalez, members of the board and members of the public. I'm Michael Plasencia, the executive officer. I can't thank the Office of Enforcement, Yvonne, David, and Catherine enough for joining us today, so I appreciate all the important information they shared. Thank you. You have my written report in your binders, but I would like to highlight a few items. First, during the month of June, staff sampled conditions at the New River twice. This required preparing bottles, tracking lab contracts, and assisting in record keeping. On July 8th, I joined Regional Board staff Emma McCorkle and Francisco Costa on a tour of the area covered by the Palo Verde Irrigated Lands General Order. We were able to see their entire water infrastructure from the diversion dam onto the Colorado River to the drains that return water back to the river. Excuse me. We met with local farmers and coalition representatives to listen to their concerns and questions regarding how the order might impact farming practices. Also in July, our management team and staff attended the Salton Sea Authority's regular meeting. The meeting provided valuable updates on environmental and public health, community-based science and data sharing, updates on projects at the sea, funding, strategic planning, and partnerships. We had an opportunity to interact with several members of their board and reiterated our commitment to supporting any work that improves public health and water quality at the sea and benefits the lives of the populations in the area. The meeting also provided updates on legislation at the state and federal levels that impact the Salton Sea and state agency projects. On August 4th, Board Member Wright and I attended the High Desert Water District Phase 2 Septic to Sewer Project groundbreaking in the town of Yucca Valley. This project, funded by the State Water Board through a $103 million State Revolving Fund grant, will act to protect local groundwater stores by redirecting wastewater discharges to treatment. Regarding this project, I'd like to take a moment to recognize a noteworthy contribution that was made by one of our board staff, Michael Perez. Michael, you want to go ahead? His name was mentioned earlier on enforcement, but this is also the other aspect. Would you like to just say hi? When I was first beginning my role as EO, Board Member Music and others informed me that recent changes to the draft Western Joshua Tree Conservation Plan could have a limiting impact on the project. I received briefings and met with High Desert Water District, and it seemed clear that working together, we could technically defend the maximum benefit of the project while securing the protection of the Joshua Tree. I put Michael in contact with representatives at High Desert and asked that he begin compiling data regarding the current condition of the Joshua Trees that had been affected by the first phase of the project over the past several years. Michael moved quickly and was an effective liaison between stakeholders of this project. His methodical data collection, attention to detail, and responsiveness were critical to the final outcome, which I am very proud of. I also included the State Water Board's press release on the project in your binders. High Desert was granted a California Endangered Species Act take permit by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife that ensured that the grant funds resulted in the highest number of populations served. We'll keep the cost of residential connections to a minimum, provide reliable sanitation service for the affected residents, and results in the protection of groundwater in the town of Yucca Valley, all while still protecting the Western Joshua Tree. So thank you, Michael, for your commitment to our shared mission and for your help with this important project. Just going to go ahead and recognize you. And this concludes my report. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you.
I guess so.
Okay, we now move to item 9, board member comments and suggestions for future agenda items. Do we have any board members that would like to discuss? Yes.
I just wanted to say that I have registered for the September 11th Desert Healthcare District Foundation public outreach and possibly tour the next day. That was full, but I put myself on the waiting list. And it's at the Weston Rancho Mirage, and Michael is going to be there at a panel. So,
thank you. Thank you. Next item is Tara's report. I also registered for the Healthy Desert, Healthy You conference. Looking forward to it. And the second day was booked. I don't know if anybody else has or if they still can. Thank you. Okay, Counselor, are there any matters for discussion in closed session?
As a matter of fact, there are. Pursuant to Government Code 11126, Subdivision A1, the board will be meeting in closed session. That is agenda item number 11. And that the purpose of that closed session is to discuss the evaluation of the performance of the executive officer. As I'm sure you'll be elaborating on further, the board has no more open session agenda items on, sorry, no more agenda items on calendar. And so the meeting will be adjourned immediately after that closed session.
Thank you. So the board will now enter into closed session. This ends the remote participation portion of this meeting. Following closed sessions, we will be returning to the room formally to adjourn the meeting. That portion will not be live streamed. The next meeting is scheduled for November 4th, 2025 at 10 a.m. and will be held at the City of Imperial Council Chambers. Imperial. City of Imperial. Thank you.